The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
This is where we ended last time, the Darwinian polls. So now I want to look at these questions. I'll just get the other things I want to do today up here. So what about the first one? You'll see what I'm talking about? Which would be a Darwinian puzzle? The ability of certain ocean-dwelling salmon to locate a distant stream by a scent in order to swim up the stream and breed. Is that going to be a problem? Does that seem like a very functional thing to do? To improve his chances of breeding, of leaving his genes? Just think about it. Second one is the readiness of some adult birds with offspring nearby to scream loudly when in the grasp of a predator. You scream loudly, you're going to attract even more predators. And you're going to... What about your babies? The third one, the discovery that when two or three extra eggs are added to the nest of some birds, the breeding adults successfully rear the additional offspring. So they've been taken advantage of by parasites. Why don't they reject the eggs? How are they benefiting? And the last one is about bats. The fact that some bats can locate and track down their prey, small flying insects, in complete darkness. Well, starting with the last one, that's certainly not a problem. Obviously, it's adaptive. The bat has evolved the ability to do that. What does he do? How does he do it? How do bats do that? In complete darkness. And we mean complete. No light at all. Yeah, they use ultrasound. Okay. So what about the other ones? Which of those might be a problem? I don't have any problem with the second one, the bird screaming. Okay. We know that can be adaptive. The babies are not going to survive anyway if she's killed. So she might as well scream and give herself some chance of startling the predator. If she emits a sudden scream, he might open his mouth, for instance. She's very quick. If he releases his grasp at all, she could get away. So I don't have a problem with that. But the salmon. You think about what that requires. It's a tremendous cost. Not the fact that he uses olfaction, because it works. He uses olfaction to find the home stream. But he goes a tremendous distance to get back to the area where she was born, to spawn. Wouldn't there have been a better way to do it? And yet that's what they've evolved to do. But why won't they do that? Anybody want to answer? I've got to eat a little sugar here. I mean, maybe it's the safest way to spawn. If that salmon was born there, it worked for him, worked for her. So if she goes back to the same place, it'll probably work for her babies too. But I just want you to see that there are large costs of breeding that way. And that's the sense in which it's a Darwinian puzzle. But obviously that is what salmon do, so the solution is just to prove that that's adaptive. Do you find any salmon in nature that don't do that? Do they breed just as well? Do they interbreed with the ones that do that, and so forth? So let's see, that leaves one about the bird that will raise baby birds from eggs that were placed in its nest by some other species. So they're strange eggs, and yet they will. First of all, why do they do it? They don't do it because they evolved to do it. They do it because they evolved to respond to eggs in a certain way. And if they're a little larger, they might even respond better, because these are the proximate mechanisms, proximate causes, right? Which evolve so she can raise her eggs. Or she and he, might be a pair of them. And maybe the costs aren't that great, rearing extra eggs. They are. It would depend a lot on their situation. Some birds can barely provide enough food for their offspring. If it costs her, if she's going to lose more of her own offspring, then of course there are very clear costs of doing that. So I think you'd have to know more. You'd have to ask, well, how often does that happen? What's the frequency that it happens? Are there any benefits? If all that happens is that the new offspring kill off her own offspring, then of course the benefits are none, and the costs are huge. So that would perhaps cause the greatest problems to a sociobiologist. Yes?
Well, with that one, wouldn't you have to consider the parents of the foreign egg? Because it serves like a huge advantage for them to have someone else rear their chicks.
Exactly. And obviously they do it because it works. But if we just talk about how that first species evolved, we know why it happens, but why haven't they evolved some defense against it? That's the puzzle. Okay. Now there was.
Is there a fixed action pattern except
the fixed action pattern? Of course, we're talking about proximate mechanisms. We know it evolves so they can take care of their own young. And another bird then is acting as a parasite. It's taking advantage. It's exploiting the fixed action pattern of the bird doing the rearing. Now, just quickly, the last question there is about a cultural anthropologist who argues about the origin of human warfare. Claims it stems from inability of pre-industrial peoples to develop a less costly or more benign means of achieving low population densities and low rates of population growth needed to prevent overexploitation of essential resources. Why would that idea not appeal to sociobiologists? It should be pretty evident. Can somebody? Yeah.
So it implies that it did evolve in order to control population, but natural selection doesn't know that it needs to control populations. It's only passing on genes.
That's right. It's difficult to think how his argument could be used by a sociobiologist to argue about how it evolved. That's right. Anyway, we could spend more time on it, but I would rather talk a little bit more about the topics of sociobiology by showing you, let's see if I can. Make this a little bigger. I did post this under the last class, but I just posted it today after I had scribbled a few notes on it. I'm not assigning you these readings. Okay, this is for a previous seminar where we were dealing with we were reading much a good portion of the associate biology book, which, by the way, for your papers, it's a good source, this or the big book, especially the latter part where he deals with specific groups of social animals. And to get started that way, it gives you a big assortment of things, would help you find things too, and then you'd have to find some more recent things also. Okay. I would like you to read through the things I've pulled out of his chapter 1 on the morality of the gene. That's the topic he's talking about. Okay? In a Darwinian sense, the organism does not live for itself. Its primary function is not even to reproduce other organisms. It reproduces genes, and it serves as their temporary carrier. That's putting it really extremely. Okay? But that's the way modern biologists look at evolution. And then he deals with some of the things we go through. The brain centers flood our consciousness with all the emotions, hate, love, guilt, fear, and others, that have evolved by natural selection. The hypothalamus and the limbic system are engineered to perpetuate DNA. That's why they occur. These brain centers in humans have been programmed to perform, the humans have been programmed to perform as if it knows, that is the brain center, as if it knows that its underlying genes will be proliferated maximally, only if it orchestrates behavioral responses. They bring into play an efficient mixture of personal survival, reproduction, and altruism. Of course, he's talking about highly social species like humans. So these centers of the brain, he means, of the brain complex, that is the limbic system, tax the conscious mind with ambivalences whenever the organisms encounter stressful situation. Love joins hate, aggression, fear, expansiveness, withdrawal, and so on, in blends designed not to promote the happiness and survival of the individual, but to favor the maximum transmission of the controlling genes. And then he talks a little bit more about those ambivalences. Counteracting pressures, you see, on the units of natural selection. What is good for the individual can be destructive to the family. What preserves the family can be harsh on both the individual and the tribe to which its family belongs. What promotes the tribe can weaken the family and destroy the individual. And so on upward through the permutations of levels of organization. He places perhaps more stress in his book on group selection than on individual selection. And Alcott places almost the entire stress on the individual. But to the extent that the individual is affected by the group, then it's certainly important what happens to the group in evolution. So I would still agree with what Wilson says there. And then he goes through what he calls the elementary concepts. And he does this before he uses a lot of illustrations, and he defines certain things that, and some of them seem a bit technical. He defines population in a specific sense, and society in a specific sense. A population is defined similar to the way we define a species. A species is a kind of population defined in terms of gene flow. Okay? The society is defined in terms of communication. So when communication suddenly drops, and you're looking across peoples, or animals, I should say, you reach the border of the society. But the population you're dealing with, genes. The dean, this term, is a specialized term that they use to mean the smallest group where there's free interbreeding. And they assume that it's done randomly. Of course, that's a big oversimplification. But that's the assumption when they develop their theories. I'm not going to go through all these terms, just a few of them that are particularly interesting for us now. The multiplier effect. He goes through an example comparing two different types of baboons. And it's very interesting because a small difference in behavior with their dominance behavior of the hamadryas baboon and the olive baboons results in pretty large differences in social structure. So a small difference in individual behavior can result in large differences by the time you get up to a group. Okay? And that's what he means. You see that in other kinds of group behavior where there's a lot of individuals interacting. I found in simulating axon growth, the large population of axons, a small difference in the way those axons behave can result in pretty big differences in the patterns they form. It's a similar kind of thing. It's a multiplier effect. The evolutionary pace maker is basically behavior. Behavioral changes, behavioral differences come first and can result later in evolution and structural change. We've talked, I'm not going to go through all of these, but we've talked about ultimate and proximate causation. That was talked about in the 75 and 80 books by Wilson. Talks about the prime movers, phylogenetic inertia, some of these things we've talked about, not all. Ecological pressures, we've talked a little bit about some of those. In the graduate class, I spent time on all these things. We discussed them in detail, but we don't have time to do all that. But if you're interested, they're all there in his book. I've marked a few other things, though. Let's talk a little bit. We've talked about how important it is that often group behavior that involves what looks like altruism, one animal doing something that helps other members of the species, will depend on his relationship. When we saw the film about meerkats, I said that the one thing I disagreed with in the commentator's description of the meerkats was when he said that one member of the group, the animal taking care of the young, might be totally unrelated to the young. That's very unlikely. Almost always that kind of behavior is for relatives. You might not have to be that closely related, but it's very likely that the meerkats are related to each other. Remember, there's other groups of meerkats, and that little film said nothing about how they find their mates. My guess is that there's outbreeding to other groups as well as inbreeding, and they didn't. Otherwise, the group would become too inbred. Okay, but let's talk about that. How do you define quantitatively how closely related you are to somebody? So we'll talk about the inbreeding coefficient, which is equivalent to the coefficient of kinship. So I've taken some things. But let's start with the mating of two half-siblings, meaning they have a common parent. Okay, here's the common parent. Here's the two half-siblings. They have different fathers, the same mother. Okay, and they mate. Here's the result, the offspring. Okay. Now, what's the probability? This is one of the alleles. Let's say that, what's the probability that A and B are the same? It's going to be one half. Okay, assuming random sorting and so forth. And that also, the probability that A and A prime are the same is also one half. That's assuming that A is not inbred. That's the assumption we have to make here. So then we need the probability that uh, A prime and B prime are the same. Again, it's that one half. So now the probability that B and B prime in the offspring here are identical is the coefficient of kinship of B and C. It's also the inbreeding coefficient of the offspring. Okay? So to get it, you'll multiply those three probabilities together. It'll be 1/8. And that's called the degree of relationship, or coefficient of kinship, or inbreeding coefficient. Now, if you accept these probabilities, Wilson just describes it in the text, and he puts this picture in. Okay. You have to note here, get it so we can see it. If we count the steps backward from one parent, here's one parent here, B, to the common ancestor, and then back to the other parent, okay, you note that there's three steps, B, A, C. Okay, you get a 3. If you take the 1/2, and let 3 be the exponent, 1/2 times 1/2 times 1/2, you get that coefficient, the inbreeding coefficient, or the degree, coefficient of relationship, okay? Coefficient of kinship, sorry. And that assumes that A is not. Now that's called path analysis, and you can do that with any pedigree. You take each possible path leading to every common ancestor. You trace it separately. And the inbreeding coefficient will be the sum of the probabilities obtained from every possible path. So I'll just give you an example here. Full sib mating. C and D are siblings. They mate. We're going to compute now the inbreeding coefficient of their offspring, or the coefficient of kinship of C and D. Okay? They have the same parents, A and B. Okay? That's why the arrows are drawn the way they are. Okay? So now let's go to one of the parents, go back to the common ancestor, and then back to the other parent. The path is simply C to A to D. Three steps. So 1/2 cubed is 1/8. Now go back to the other parent. Okay? C to B to D. Okay? Three steps. You get 1/8 again. You add these two probabilities now, and you get the inbreeding coefficient, 1/4. You can do the same thing for other. I took the two that Wilson used. I could have done it for other pedigrees here. First cousin mating. Okay? Here are the cousins. They mate and have offspring. Okay? They're cousins because they're children of different siblings that were born to these parents, A and B. Right? So now, trace back. From one parent, back to a common ancestor, back to the other parent. E, C, A, D, F. You get 1/2 to the 5th now, because we're 5 steps. 1/32. Now go back to the other common ancestor. B, E, C, B, D, F. You get 1/2 to the 5th again. So you get 1/32 plus 1/32. So 1/16 is the coefficient of kinship. Okay? So less related than in the previous example with full sib mating. Okay? So you get the idea that you can compute a number then for how related they are, the probability that they will share genes at any given locus. Okay? Of the same genes, the identical alleles at one locus, And what's the problem with identical alleles in one locus? Won't necessarily be a problem if they're normal genes. But if they're abnormal genes, they can't be offset by a normal gene. Okay, then there's a big problem. Might even be a lethal problem. Okay. And he took a complex pedigree here. Here's the offspring. Okay. The mating of one of their parents. They're both offspring of one parent. Okay. The other common ancestor is out here. So you have to trace the two paths, E, D, F, and then E, D, B, A, C, F. And you get these. Actually, Wilson did it incorrectly in the book. He gave this as 132nd. But I count six steps, so it's actually 164th. So you get 964th coefficient relationship. But anyway, that's how sociobiologists get involved in numbers from the field of population biology. Okay, that's where these things came from. Now, just a couple other concepts. He discusses inbreeding taboos, and it's interesting because it wasn't, at the time he wrote this, a settled topic at all. There were still a lot of questions about it. It's very clear in humans. Even some of the data were collected in the kibbutzim in Israel, where even when inbreeding is not part of the instruction given to children, almost never occurs. But he didn't take into account data that show that how common various forms of incest are in human families. So it's not a rigid thing. But in fact, in almost every species that have been looked at, inbreeding is not common. Time to discuss all these other concepts here. Let's define just a couple more things. The carrying capacity of the environment and R and K selection. Okay. The carrying capacity environment is for an animal living in a particular environment, if the population reaches a stable level, and that level of population will differ according to the environment. So in an environment rich in food, without too many predators, they can reach a higher level than in a harsher environment. Okay? They will breed faster if they're below the carrying capacity environment. If they get above it, the population will decline and reach the carrying capacity. Species that behave like that are called K selection species. The human is a good example. These come from a formula for population number change. It involves R and K, the carrying capacity environment. The R in animals are animals that simply breed as many as possible. Okay? And the result is that many of them die. They would very quickly get above the carrying capacity environment. And some of those populations show rapid increases and then population crashes. And then it will go up again and then crash again. I was going to give you that formula and everything, but I don't expect you to remember it anyway, so I won't spend time on it. It's all there. They spend a lot of time in sociobiology discussing altruism, but also the related concepts of selfishness and spite. Spite is when you do something bad to somebody and it lowers your own fitness overall. Okay. Why would they do it? Because it can help a relative.
Because it can what?
Help a relative. So you're still doing it to promote your genes. Selfish behavior, one that would increase your genetic fitness at the expense of another individual. Altruism also can be at the expense. It can cause some reduction in your own fitness, but it's not overall. Your genetic fitness will not be decreased because you're helping relatives in general. And these terms mostly come from William Hamilton, who gave the clearest discussion of that. Okay, and then he goes on, talks about group size and reproduction. We've had a little discussion of that in the Alcock and the Scott, mostly in Scott. There'll be a little more of it in Alcock. Then he talks about development, modification of social behavior, including learning and play, and that's some things we've talked about. Then he goes through a long section on communication. We had one chapter on communication in Scott that introduced many of these same concepts, although it's in some additional concepts here. Goes through all of these different functions of communication, many more than were mentioned in the Scott book. I mean, remember, he was a synthesizer and he reviewed a lot of literature on different groups and he found all these different kinds of functions of communication. And then he spends a little extra time on these complex systems, ring doves, extreme courtship displays, whale songs, gorilla and chimp displays. He goes through different types of communication. And then I just gave the chapter titles here. He talks specifically about aggression, social spacing, territory, dominant systems, roles and caste, sex and society, parental care. We've talked a little bit about all of those things in the class. And then I did not include in my, I didn't even list here, the rest of the chapters where he discusses the specific groups. That covers in his up to page 175 or 176. And then he has his part three is social species. Okay. Then he goes through the colonial invertebrates, the social insects, the cold-blooded vertebrates, the birds, evolutionary trends within mammals. And then he talks more specifically about ungulates and elephants, the carnivores, the non-human primates, and finally, the very last chapter, man, from sociobiology to sociology. And it was that chapter that got him in all the trouble, even though he's very clear that he's being speculative and so forth. And there's other people that became much more speculative in other books, much more than Wilson did, talking about humans. I could bring some of those to class if you'd like to look. They're actually quite fascinating to read. The earliest one I read was called The Naked Ape. It's about humans. All kinds of speculations using evolutionary thinking and so forth to talk about. But of course, very speculative because there weren't data for a lot of things that he talked about. Okay. What time is it? Well, we have a little time. This is class 23 now. Genetic influences on social behavior. Yeah, please.
Spring is the time when everything starts reproducing, and the fall is the time when you take everything back. That's why you hunt and collect agricultural things in the fall, but you don't hunt in the spring because when both plants and animals are producing offspring, but by the fall, that's when you can hunt. Is it true that species living in the same environment will synchronize their breeding cycle?
No, remember, species are competing with each other. Okay? But it does work out when food is most plentiful is the best time to breed, too. But you also want to be safe. So many birds actually will have their babies when it's still, there's still snow on the ground, it's still, and they're already nesting. Because remember, when the babies are little small, they are very small, they need less food. But they're not all synchronized at all. It's just most common. And you can't say about anything involving feeding that it's just at some times of year, unless you're dealing with an animal that can store food. Like hamsters will go out and hoard the most in times in the late part of the growing season when the seeds are available and other things they hoard.
Have they breed in the winter or do they breed in the... Do they breed before hoarding or after hoarding or during hoarding?
They breed during the long days. I know that not from studies in the wild, but because we know that when you keep, you can't breed hamsters, you can keep them on short day length. And people that house hamsters and have the day length too short will have more trouble breeding them. I always keep them on a 14-10, 14 hours light, 10 hours darkness. Okay. And that will make the male's testicles grow and they will breed more readily. Okay. So think of species as competing, but also they all breed better when the food is very plentiful and temperatures are not so harsh and so forth. But animals have different adaptations. So they... Okay, let's talk a little bit about this idea of genetic determination, which has been one of the things that people have argued against sociobiology about. They claim that they're genetic determinists. So my first question is, what is the difference between genetic determination of behavioral traits and sociobiologists' views concerning genes and behavior? Okay, and too much. Get it so we can see it here. And I'll just call your attention to these things that I took right out of Alcock. First of all, the genetic studies used by sociobiologists, they're not really dealing with developmental genetics at all, but population genetics, okay? They deal with the consequences of population changes and the frequency of different variants, the alleles of given genes, not with the physiological means by which those particular alleles are acting, okay, shaping biochemical pathways, determining, of course, proteins. The failure to distinguish between ultimate and proximate research in biology is at the heart of the unfair charge that sociobiologists are trying to establish that genes are us. Okay? Then every modern biologist knows that nothing's totally determined by the genes. It depends on the environment as well. It depends on the environment in the uterus. It depends on the environment outside. And he goes through a critic's argument, which was designed to be plausible there in four steps. And the last step, they end up talking about the existence of traits that are hereditary, fixed, inevitable, and unchangeable, except by future selection for hereditary alternatives. Well, it's true that the genes might be fixed and inevitable, but they imply that that means the behavior they're affecting is also fixed, inevitable, and unchangeable, which is not the case. And every modern biologist knows that. So he asks why this myth, the myth of the deterministic sociobiologist, has been so enduring since Wilson, not just in reaction to his book initially, when it was perhaps a more novel idea, because he, at least when applied to humans and applied so widely. But why has it been so persistent? And Alcock tries to First of all, he says, well, it's a convenient straw man for the argument. But what I find interesting is his discussion of human psychology. And we talked about this about the early in the class, about the history of education in the U.S. I said that the belief that we're determined not by our genes but by our environment, we all have the same chance, we're all equal. It just depends on how hard we try and so forth. I mean, it may not be true, but it gave birth to universal education in America, a very positive attitude towards education, and so forth. So it's important to human psychology to believe in our ability to change our behavior and other people's behavior, too. But for some people, this flexibility of human behavior is, as he says, mistakenly taken as evidence that cultural factors are the only real determinants of our actions. So basically, they take it too far, you see. They forget the other side. They want to champion free will and freedom of action, and that's so important to many people, you see, that these arguments about sociobiology have just persisted. Okay, now, I didn't get figure 3.1 scan. My scanner's still not working, and I don't have the figures for this book. So if you have it, look at figure 3.1. Now, it's very simple, okay? It's on page 47. He basically shows little depiction of the genetics of two individuals, the two fertilized eggs, one and two, that differ in one gene, B. Different alleles, okay? And he presents them as having identical alleles at one gene locus, one capital B and one little b, okay? Now that genetic difference then results in differences in behavior. First of all, he points out it depends on an interaction with the environment. What that means is that the result of the gene will differ according to the environment that's present. So that leads to differences in development, which changes, of course. If you're going to change behavior, you're changing neurons, which cause the behavioral differences. So in the adult, you end up with differences, but it depends on both genes and environment. A small change, depending on how it interacts with the environment, can end up, when you get the final behavior in the adult, it can be a kind of multiplier effect, especially since that change might be a small difference in early childhood, could be amplified by interactions all the way up to adulthood, so you could end up having a much larger effect. So then I asked here, well, about changing gene frequencies, explain how the relative frequency of these two alleles, B and B in question 3, could change over multiple generations. So I'm just, to get you to think about that, I spelled out here some possibilities. First of all, one of the alleles could result in death before the age of reproduction. Well, in that case, the frequency is going to change pretty rapidly, right? How would it persist at all? Well, it might be a recessive gene. So it might be capital B, small b. So you might have carriers. Okay, so the gene could persist. But whenever an animal with a pair of those genes was born, it could lead to death before the age of reproduction. Now, if that happens, that gene will decrease in frequency. Okay, now I'll take the other. Let's say it's not lethal in that sense. let's say it resulted in a behavioral difference that reduced the probability of successful reproduction in particular environments but not other environments. Okay? Then what? Well, then, if the environments were quite separate and there was not a lot of crossing of people between, or animals between the two environments, okay, then obviously it's going to decrease in frequency in one environment and not in the other. Okay? But the likelihood that that gene will persist then is very great if in some environments it doesn't have the effect. And so with a little, with some gene flow between the different populations, that gene is going to keep showing up. Okay? And there's many examples of that. Let's say B resulted in no change in probability of reproduction, meaning having the offspring, but it reduced parental care. Well, then it would depend on the effects of reduced parental care. It would depend on the species, right? Maybe there would be an adjustment. Maybe it affects the male. And the male has the gene, doesn't put any care in, but the female compensates, increases her care, so the offspring survive. So then that gene is not going to change very rapidly in frequency, okay? But it could have a more drastic effect. Okay? So these are the kinds of possibilities. I want you to just see how complex the whole thing is, talking about change in gene frequencies. Okay? Yeah, we're at the end of the class. I want you to think about artificial selection. And when you talk about human, I said, how has this been supported by studies? We know we can do selective breeding, and we can breed for behavioral traits. And again and again, it's been shown that you can alter behavior. You know, and some of them can be things that affect social behavior. So I want you to read about the twin studies, okay? It's actually a very interesting topic in general, and it's been used by psychologists a number of times.